This is the Fatty Joe Show, coming to you from Casa de Carey, deep in the forests of Nutmeggerville. This show is dedicated to exploring pathways to better health from a holistic perspective. In each episode, we will explore such topics as nutrition, mental and emotional health, fitness, and more. I'm Yogi, your host. And I became interested in studying health after conventional health dogma became damaging and led me to become massively overweight. Against modern convention, I went on a keto lifestyle and I lost over 300 pounds and gained a level of control on my personal health that I never had before. Now I'm on a journey to find out what is myth and what is truth in the ever-convoluted world of what is considered healthy. Come join me on a journey of discovery as I look for a path to improve total health. If you'd like to support the show, head over to patreon.com/thefattyjoeshow or patreon.com/carriebrown. If you want to check out all of our social media links and recipes, head to carriebrown.com. Don't forget to leave a comment, like, and subscribe to the show. Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Fatty Joe Show. This is our interview with Gary Taubes, scientific journalist and author of such books as Good Calories, Bad Calories, The Case Against Sugar, and The Case for Keto. Gary's been a fixture in the keto community for quite some time, and his books has helped many people get on a better keto lifestyle and make better nutritional choices. He was an early influence for Carrie Brown, and he also was a big influence on myself when we were switching over and trying to formulate a whole healthy keto diet. I used his books quite a bit, and so did Carrie. So this is part of our early influencer series, and I'm recording this intro because the original intro that we recorded together wasn't coming across very well when we listened to the recording. There were some connection issues with Zoom, and the original introduction was so fuzzy, cutting in and out, and sounded a lot like a Dalek from Doctor Who. So we had to cut that part out, and I had to record a new introduction to go over the top of it. But anyway, I hope you all enjoy the show.
Well, thank you, Yogi, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We know a little bit about your story, but what got you into researching nutrition and bringing out the science against the high-carb diet and the typical Ansel Keys formula?
Well, I was a physics major in college, not a very good one, but and then I got a journalism degree, and then I went into science journalism, and I ended up just by chance writing my first book about a group of physicists who discovered non-existent elementary particles. So they, in fact, I was embedded with them. That's a language you'd use now. This was a long time ago, 35 years ago. And I got to watch them screw up and discover something that didn't exist. And I became fascinated with good science, bad science, and what it took to get the right answer. It's very easy in science to get the wrong answer. So my second book was on the same subject. It's called Bad Science. And when I was done with that, some of my friends in the physics community said, if you're interested in bad science, you should look at the stuff in public health. It's terrible. And so I moved into public health. This was the early 90s. And it turned out that the research was just as bad as my physicist friends had said it was. And I started moving sort of through fields, looking at sort of fundamental assumptions and the tools they were using and the methodology they were using. And in the late 90s, I kind of stumbled into nutrition just by chance. And it turned out that some of the things that we all believed, starting with the idea that you get hypertension, high blood pressure, because you eat salt-rich diets, was just based on really terrible science. And so I went through, I did an investigation for the journal Science on salt and blood pressure, and then turned out some of the people who were major figures there were the major figures who got us to eat low-fat diets in the 90s, the high-carb, low-fat diet that we all grew up on. So I went from salt to fat, and then from there to obesity, and spent 5 years working on my first book, Good Calories, Bad Calories. And, you know, it was kind of like from the journalistic perspective or the science journal investigative reporter perspective, this horrible injustice had been perpetrated on all of us. These people in the 60s and 70s went out and told us they knew how we should eat to be healthy, and they had really no idea, and they put us on these diets that seem to have done far more harm than good, and then they can't get off of what they told us then. So I just got kind of committed as a journalist and something of an advocate to trying to get the science right and the nutrition right, because we've all been getting heavier and more diabetic as a nation, as a world, and we've got to fix it.
Yeah. And I mean, I've seen a lot of that firsthand. I used to work at group homes for at-risk kids, and they're still very much the Ansel Keys model. And we would be slamming high carbohydrate diets into kids who were on insulin and type 2 diabetic. And it's one of the areas that I'd like to see some change at. And I'm hoping that we will learn enough that we as a movement can change the model of what we're eating away from the lobbyist interests.
Well, and it's not just the lobbyist interests, because although that may be a large part of it, I'm doing a new book on diabetes, and I was specifically on diabetes. All my books have been at least peripherally about diabetes as well, but this one is targeted at it. And I was interviewing one of the experts on diabetes from a low carb perspective, and she was talking about when her daughter was in, I guess, first grade, they had a field trip, so she had to go into school with the field trip, and there was four kids in the class who are lower socioeconomic status. They're all minorities. This is Indiana, so it's a pretty, you know, Caucasian neighborhood. And these kids are overweight, and they're the ones who are getting the school breakfast because their parents can't provide it. And the breakfast is apple juice and donuts, or apple juice and Pop-Tarts. And so you're taking these kids who are at high risk for diabetes, or low socioeconomic status, their parents are, you know, obese and diabetic, and then you load them up on these carb-rich diets because they fit what the USDA guidelines say a healthy diet should be, despite being loaded with sugar, loaded with highly refined carbs. And, you know, you're, from the moment they enter school, you're putting them at a worse and worse, a greater and greater disadvantage every year. So, yeah. There are some serious problems that have to be fixed.
Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of it has to do, you were mentioning bad science before on basis of your books too. There's so much contradictory information out there, and the average layperson really doesn't know how to skim through it to find the solid information or look at the research in a way that gives them the right information. I mean, the same is true with COVID. You have certain thing, people looking at certain information on one side, information on the other. There's very opposite approaches, it seems like, even in the medical industry. And I think for those of us who are not in with medical training, it can be very confusing.
Well, and this is one of the problems with the internet, is it's opened up the world. So it used to be 60 years ago, you listen to your doctor and maybe the American Heart Association, and you read some of your local newspaper, and that's the advice you got. And they completely controlled, they were the gatekeeper, so you only got one perspective. And then the internet, and then there were diet book doctors and nutrition. So you could read, if it wasn't working, you could read a diet book, you could read Atkins, or you could read, you know, one of the Pritikin or and try something that was considered a fad diet because it wasn't the conventional wisdom. And then the internet comes along and suddenly everyone's got a voice and everyone's successful. Now you have the opposite problem. Now it's like, who do you believe? So you can find information on everything or anything, and some of it's right and some of it's wrong. And I mean, it's crazy that, you know, people would take diet advice from a journalist like myself is kind of insane on one level. And yet, you know, the flip side is people like me and Nina Teicholz, we had the opportunity to look at the data without bias. We weren't indoctrinated into any medical disciplines, belief system. But I don't know, you know, the advantage, so answering your question, who do you know what to believe? The advantage is you with diet, you could try it yourself. So like, I'm sure you tried a lot of different things over the years, none of which worked. And then you fall into this, you say, well, this makes sense. I'll try it. And then lo and behold, it works. And by work means it kind of fixes your metabolic abnormalities. You can tell it works. Whereas if you're, you know, one of the reasons we all went on low fat diets is we thought it was supposed to prevent heart disease, right? But you can't actually tell if a diet's preventing heart disease. Like, you don't know when you would have died without the diet. And so if you live to be 80 or you die at 70 or 90, you have no idea whether the diet helped or hurt. Whereas if you try the low carb, you know, ketogenic diet and you lose 50 pounds and your blood pressure gets better, there's a pretty good chance that you're healthier, right? There's a, like, the way you eat might be high in saturated fat, but if you're 300 pounds lighter, it's hard to argue that you're less healthy than you used to be.
Yeah, I actually didn't start the diet for weight loss. I didn't believe I would have weight loss doing it. I started doing it because I was experiencing symptoms of CTE because I was an athlete most of my life before trucking, played football, rugby, got hit in the head a lot, worked security, got beer bottles smashed on my head.
I did the football and I did boxing.
Yeah.
And I bounced in bars, but I let other people, my other fellow bouncer friends who really like to fight, to let them get hit in the head by beer bottles. But I still get the CTE issues.
Yeah, I never really did like to fight. I just happened to be usually the larger one in the room. So if somebody was going to go after somebody, they were going to go after the larger guy. And so that's kind of what would happen. But The results that I got were better. I tried the vegan thing. I tried the vegetarian thing. The health results and the way I felt and the way my brain fired up and functioned better was unlike anything else. And that you were part of the research that I did. You, Dominic DiAgostino, I read their research. And I was still very skeptical. And the only way I knew that it worked was actually by trying it. And we have a lot of different dogmatic ideas out there that are floating around about diet. People say you should be vegan. People say you should be all raw foods. I mean, we even have a group of people that are talking about drinking raw water that's going to, you know, increase their health. So it is kind of a murky field to try to wade through to get to the other side.
Yeah, and again, it's sort of... Okay, advertising. This is what I'm trying to put into context in my new book, which will be out in December. Like I said, the difference is you could try it. So you tried this. I mean, you could try the raw water thing. I don't know what makes water raw, but you could try, you know, one of the, so this book, The Case for Keto, I interviewed about 120 plus physicians who have sort of converted to our way of thinking, and that they used to assume that we should all eat balanced diets, relatively low in fat. And if you're overweight, you should eat, you know, low calorie diets. They all have this pretty much the same experience, which is their patients are getting heavier, they're more diabetic. And if you're in family medicine or internal medicine in the United States, many places around the world, most of what you're dealing with are the complications of obesity and diabetes in your patients and hypertension. And so they're assuming that their patients aren't losing weight because they're not listening to them. And then they start getting heavier. And then they think, what the fuck? I'm getting heavier here and I'm taking my advice. I know I'm taking my advice, so maybe my advice is wrong.
Yeah.
So now they go looking and they try vegan diets or vegetarian diets because that's a natural thing to try. And if that succeeds, I never hear from them. They don't respond to my Twitter post saying what diet worked for you. You should interview me. But if it doesn't work, and most of us went through periods in our life, like for about 6 years in the 90s, I ate a very low fat diet. I mean, I figure it was probably about 15 to 20% fat. I used to joke in the 90s, I boiled 10,000 eggs and threw out 10,000 yolks. My breakfast was egg whites, oatmeal, and apple juice, because I wouldn't put milk on the oatmeal. I would use apple juice. And I would eat the oatmeal raw because I was young and healthy and it was easier to eat raw oatmeal than cook it. Lunch was pasta with fresh salsa. And I wouldn't even put olive oil in the making the pasta be in the water because I thought that the fat would give me heart disease. And dinner was like skinless chicken breasts and rice and salads and salads and salads. And I just kept getting heavier and heavier. Then I tried Atkins back in 2000 or 1999. That ketogenic diet was still called Atkins. And I tried it as an experiment because actually an economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology suggested I try it. We were in a conversation about good science and bad science. I told him about the stuff I was doing on dietary fat and how bad it was. And he said, if you're writing about dietary fat, you got to try Atkins. He said he had his collaborator was at the Wharton School of Business in Philadelphia, graduate of, I think Trump graduated from Wharton. His collaborator's father lost 200 pounds on Atkins, and he said he tried it and lost 40 pounds. And he said, you got to try it. It's this high fat, high saturated fat diet, and you just see what happens. And I tried it, and I lost 25 pounds. Effortlessly. Like I had been working out an hour a day. I was watching my calories every day. I was just getting heavier. And so one way to wade through it is just to try them all.
Yeah.
You know, the raw fruit diet clearly works for some people in that they're healthy on it and they're healthier than they used to be.
Go ahead.
I was going to say what they don't know is would they be healthier if they were on like a ketogenic diet, if they were eating the way you're eating.
Yeah.
And
I think, go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, there are people out there who say they used to eat keto and they switched to vegetarian diets and they feel better. And I believe that's true. But you don't know, for me and for most of the people who end up advocating for low carb, high fat, ketogenic diets, we do it because the research supports us, the sort of evolutionary story supports us. And we see people getting healthier by eating this way.
You know? I was going to say, a lot of the research doesn't take into account the biodiversity of people and what different maybe genetic functions are going on or epigenetic results of what the parents did cause damage. Or there's so many variables to a human body, it's insane. So I definitely like the N equals one type experimentation for what works for you.
Well, ultimately, it's always going to be an N of one. But I think there are what makes me nervous about the sort of individual variation story is it's used to argue that this is a multifactorial complex problem that requires multifactorial. That's the cliche, multifactorial complex solutions. But there are questions you could ask that have simple answers. This is how in the case against sugar. So for instance, what you experienced, what I experienced to a much lesser extent, is a common phenomenon in every population in the world whenever they embrace a Western diet and lifestyle. So there's clearly massive genetic differences between populations and the epigenetics of the intrauterine environment. What happens when you're in your mother's womb is clearly programs you for later life. But the question is, what do you have to add to a population's diet such that they become obese and diabetic over the next 20, 40, 60 years. That population manifests. The way geneticists would say is, they talk about genotype, which is the genes you're born with, and phenotype, which is how those genes manifest themselves in different environments. So you could take any genotype, any population around the world, add the Western diet and lifestyle to it, and you end up with this obese diabetic phenotype. Suddenly you've got more and more people are obese and diabetic, and each generation it gets worse. Because if your mother was predisposed to be diabetic when she was pregnant with you, you're going to be predisposed to be obese and diabetic as you get older. So each generation is going to get worse. And then you ask, what do you add to that diet? And it could be, you know, you could be talking like Inuits who are living on, you know, whale meat and seal and caribou, or the Native Americans who are living on, you know, buffalo and elk, or Maasai in Africa who were drinking the milk and eating the meat from the cattle they were herding, or agrarian agricultural populations in Europe, in Asia, you know, who are living primarily on rice or wheat. And doesn't matter what their diet was, add the Western diet and they start getting obese and diabetic. And the answer to that, I think, is simple. You just got to figure out what it is, because it's clearly almost assuredly going to be the same thing everywhere. And then once you've created the problem, you're going to have people who, you know, some people can tolerate that diet and some people can't. So some people some populations, let's say, you know, my theory, it's Coca-Cola. Add Coca-Cola to any population, which Coca-Cola did their best to do. And you know, 20, 40 years later, you end up with a whole bunch of obese and diabetic people, but not everybody in the population is obese and diabetic. So some people can tolerate the Coke, some people can't. Unfortunately, the ones of us who can't are the ones who become obese and diabetic and have to give it up. So
I've been rereading the Nutrition and Physical Degeneration by Weston A. Price, and it was pretty remarkable how early on to the introduction of the Western diet on cultures around the world, that the first thing they would see within one generation is the facial structure would change.
Right.
And the other thing was tuberculosis was rather rampant, but most people were able to fight it off and stay asymptomatic. But once the Western diet was introduced, they became symptomatic and had a lot more health issues.
Yeah, it's funny because I forgot Weston Price. So I don't know how much you've talked about him on your podcast. Weston Price, for those who don't know, was a Cleveland dentist who, Cleveland or Dayton, I forget which, an Ohio dentist who in the 1930s traveled around the world with his wife and visited all these, and tried to do kind of controlled studies. So he starts off in Switzerland. He visits the village up in the Swiss Alps. It's so far from any road that they basically have to live on whatever they can, grow in the soil in the snowy Alps, or, you know, that their animals provide. And then he visits, it's Zurich, and examines people in Zurich. And because he's a dentist, he's looking at their teeth and their jaw formation. And he goes to Africa and he visits like pygmy populations. And then he tries to find the same populations in urban centers eating the same genetic background, eating modern foods. He goes to the U.S. and visits Native American populations in Canada. He sees First Nations. He goes to the South Pacific. And he writes this book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, which is a great read. It's just a travel book. I mean, it's... You know, I remember reading it and thinking, okay, this guy's making this stuff up. Like, he tells a story about how pygmies kill elephants. You remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
They sneak up behind them and they saw through their
foot. Yeah.
On the back of their legs.
Almost
and the
like
elephants, for some reason, the elephants don't have nerves back there, so they don't feel the pain. And then when they've crippled the elephant so that it can't run, then they can kill it with spears and stuff. And you think, this is total crap. And then you turn the page and there's a picture of Mrs. Price, who's this middle-aged Cleveland woman in a khaki skirt and a pith helmet. And she's standing next to two pygmies who are holding tusks that are like you know, twice as big as they are. And you think, yeah, maybe he really did this. And anyway, the story is, as you say, every population eating Western diets, cavities, dental caries is a technical thing, jaw dis. It's funny, I tried to keep my kids away from sugar, just hoping because of Western price, thinking maybe I could save money on braces, which so far I haven't, by the way. So I'm not sure he was right about that. But that's the observation. Western diets and the tooth decay and the jaw damage is like the canary in the coal mine. You see that first, and you see that in kids. And then you see appendicitis, and then obesity, diabetes, heart disease, cancer rates go up, Alzheimer's, well, dementia rates go up, gout goes up, arthritis goes up, all these diseases that later became known as sort of diseases of Western lifestyles.
Well, a lot of these diseases, too, used to be the diseases of affluence. When yeah. sugar was very expensive and people couldn't get it, the type 2 diabetes was something that royalty would get.
Right. And gout was something royalty would. Started out as the sort of disease of kings and the disease of royalty. And then it, as sugar becomes more and more popular, as it becomes cheaper and cheaper and it becomes more and more the sort of required food of the lower classes, and you see these diseases, type 2 diabetes, obesity, gout spreading to the lower classes as well. That's one of the arguments I made in the book, The Case Against Sugar, which is why, you know, maybe it's just, it sounds, so the conventional wisdom, right, is when you make westernized populations, they get more food. And so now they could eat too much, and then they get all these labor-saving devices, and they don't have to work physically for a living, so they can, you've got to, you know, take in more energy than they expend, and that's why they get fatter, and everything else comes from that. And then the counter-argument that I and others have been making is, you know, you add sugar and refined flour, white flour, to diet, and you get this sort of all kinds of metabolic effects that include, you know, getting fatter, getting diabetic, blood sugar issues, blood pressure issues. It affects, you know, throughout the body.
Yeah. And I've also been reading quite a bit about the fact that because we have a growing issue of dietary and lifestyle related illnesses, that it is really going to affect the GDP. Country, if this trend continues to rise with as many people that are getting sick and now having to seek medical and putting a stress on the medical industry as far as trying to provide resources to help people through things like diabetes and autoimmune issues and things like that. Where do you see the trend going? Do you see us kind of tapering off in the future, or do you think we're going to still keep climbing until?
I don't know. I don't know. It depends how much influence we've had pushing our agenda. If the conventional wisdom had stayed what it was, you know, you're worrying about fat, sugar's fine, flour, refined flour is fine, then you're just going to have populations getting fatter and more diabetic and with all these complications. Things have been changing, though, so we have made progress. If you look at health guidelines now and nutrition discussions, people are focusing on ultra-processed foods as a problem. And when they're talking about ultra-processed foods, which is another buzzword I'm not fond of, but that's what they use, they're talking about sugar and white flour and vegetable oils for the most part, seed oils. And if you're avoiding those foods, what, you know, our parents would have called junk food. Except that if you're a trucker, for instance, you're going to eat it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, not just for snacks. Because it's all you can buy on the road and truck stops. It's an interesting problem. I used to talk about this. Well, one of the things I did was I co-founded a not-for-profit called the Nutrition Science Initiative, or NUSI. And the goal of NUSI was to raise funds to do research that could really nail down some of these issues, and we did not succeed, to put put it mildly. And at the moment, Nusi is in hibernation while I figure out how to continue doing what we were doing all along, trying to do, which was raise money for this research. But the I used to, in these Nusi documents, we would always talk about how much it costs for the medical community. So the direct medical costs for obesity and diabetes in the United States are about $1 billion a year, $1 billion a day. And the indirect costs are about $1 trillion a year. And by indirect costs, it's lost wages, you know, lost productivity, things like that. So this seems like, and the prediction is it's going to bankrupt the healthcare system. But on the other hand, about 5 years ago, I was giving a lecture at the Cleveland Clinic, and it actually was 7 years ago, because I remember it was the day after LeBron James and the Miami Dolphins, the Miami Heat beat the San Antonio Spurs after the Spurs are up by five, like 30 seconds to go in the game. And never had I gotten such love from a Cleveland audience as when I commented negatively about LeBron James the next morning. anyway, the point is, they gave me a tour of the Cleveland Clinic, and they had like a dozen new buildings going up. It's, so even though it costs, you know, you talk about $340 billion in healthcare costs, or $1 billion a day in healthcare costs, those healthcare costs are being paid to physicians in the medical establishment. They're going to the pharmaceutical industry. So there's it's great business to have a world that's obese and diabetic. I mean, on the flip side, our insurance rates keep going up and stuff like that. So I'm not sure there's a really sufficient motivation in the pharmaceutical industry. There's motivation to treat the disorder. In the medical community and the surgical community, they're happy to treat the disorder because they can get paid for treating the disorder. There isn't a lot of motivation to prevent it. And when you start preventing it, if you start telling people what not to eat, and the foods that we're telling people not to eat are the foods that the American food industry, you know, the huge conglomerates produce, the PepsiCos and the Coca-Colas and the General Mills and the, you know, the cereals and the breads and the fruit juices and the sodas, there's not a lot of motivation in the, there's a lot of, you know, talk by these industries that they want to help, but there really isn't a lot of effort going into serious prevention and serious dietary treatment.
And it seems too, without that look of the to the sustainability of the path of treating these illnesses, it's also a national security issue, because we just recently had some generals that came out and said we've got people that are too fat, too sick to join the military.
I was going to say that's where I think we'll make progress, where people really need effective solutions. So like if you want, that's, you know, for instance, Navy SEALs have kind of embraced ketogenic and paleo diets because they realize that by eating this way, they can improve their physical fitness and improve their performance. Ultra endurance athletes are beginning to embrace these diets because they can improve their fitness and endurance by doing it. They can improve their performance. When you're talking about the military, you're talking about a group that really needs, you know, it's nice, like I said, to prevent heart disease, which is why we're eating the low-fat diet. I don't want to die of a heart attack in 30 years, so I'm going to change my diet today. We don't know if that's really true, but that's the thinking. And I would argue that the studies never panned out. But the idea that if I want a lean, trim fighting force, if I want the young men and women of America to be a healthy weight, I got to get them off the crap carbohydrates they're eating and drinking. And I have to replace those calories with fat. So I have to convince them that dietary fat is going to kill them, and saturated fat. Basically, I have to tell them the exact opposite of what we've been telling them for 50 years. But we always hope that groups like the military will help affect this change in this country, because they have a vested interest in seeing healthier troops. Whether the troops live to be 60 or 70 or 80 isn't quite as important as that they be healthy in their 20s.
Right. And it was kind of the military that also stimulated the low fat, high calorie carbohydrate diet in the first place too, because they were trying to figure out how to put weight on to, because at the time, the opposite, they had the opposite problem. They had a lot of underweight people that wouldn't pass the physical to get in the military. So they were trying to bulk them up. So they said sugar and flour.
Well, this is the thing. There's a lot of, again, it's hard to imagine how, well, the questions we want to answer today weren't questions anyone was asking back then. So we want to know, you know, how do these obesity and diabetes epidemics get started and what keeps them going? And then how do we fix them? And then back then they didn't realize they had obesity and diabetes epidemics because they were still sort of, you know, low on the curve. And they were asking questions like that. I mean, some of the first studies of low carbohydrate diets were done by Air Force doctors who wanted to slim down pilots who were overweight. And they would report on the remarkable efficacy of low-carb diets to do this. But the, you know, the nutrition people, they were driven by this, how do we prevent heart disease idea. They didn't care what these doctors said. They didn't care that to them it was, if a diet slimmed down a pilot for a year but then killed him of heart disease 40 years later, that wasn't a benefit. Yeah. And then they believe that the way you slim down to begin with is eat less, because, you know, all of these people, one of the revelations from my new book, and I'm embarrassed to call it a revelation, and I'm embarrassed that I didn't realize this 20 years ago when I first started writing about this subject, but this whole thinking about obesity, like if you read an article on a newspaper website that takes comments, and it's about some new obesity treatment, there'll always be people saying, well, you know, it's about eating less and exercising more, and anyone who thinks differently is a quack. So the idea always was you weighed 600 pounds because you ate too much. And you ate too much because, yeah, you ate enough to be 600 pounds, but the problem is why does your body want to be 600 pounds? Yeah. I have, I'm going to call him a very good friend, somebody I love dearly, who was at his heaviest, 6'5", 190 pounds. And he used to say he never gets stuffed. He just gets bored of eating after a couple of hours. It was toasted oatmeal raisin bread. Not oatmeal raisin bread. Toasted raisin bread with peanut butter, jelly, and granola. And he would make six of these, and he would carry them out in a pile on a paper towel, and he would eat them on the way back to his dorm. And he couldn't get over 195 pounds. Couldn't get over 195. Okay? So clearly the idea is there's something different between what your body did with the food and what his body did that was independent of how much you or he was eating.
Yeah, I saw that a lot when I was growing up because I had friends that were stuck on video games all the time, and I'm out there lifting weights and running on the track and playing football, and I'm still getting, because I graduated high school with 600 pounds, dropped a bunch of weight, and then gained it back again after getting hit by a car. But I struggled most of my teenage adult life. I struggled with keeping the weight down. Whereas I had friends that ate garbage and sat in front of the TV and
didn't get fat. Yeah, exactly. Well, this is one of the things when I think about what's criminal all about this, and the revelation, this idea that you get fat because you eat too much, is the way thin people think about fat people. So what they're thinking is, I'm lean and I eat in moderation. And actually, until the 1970s, they didn't even exercise. But we'll throw in I exercise in moderation. And therefore, if everyone ate in moderation and exercise, they'd be lean too. And if they're not lean, it must mean they don't eat in moderation, they don't exercise enough. So this whole idea that it's all about how much you eat and exercise is the way thin people think about fat people. And then they make people like you feel guilty because you feel like you're failing yourself, instead of thinking, look, this person accumulates fat easily and I don't. So instead of studying what's wrong with their brain, which is what obesity science became and is today. Like, you find more people are, like, they're throwing obese people in MRI machines and MRIing their brain to try and figure out how their brains differ from thin people instead of figuring out why their bodies accumulate fat. Like, what is your body doing that mine isn't? Or mine didn't do nearly as much. I, too, was getting a little fatter every year, but I was 180 when I graduated from high school. No, 190. And I could never get over 240, although now I could probably go up to 300 if I really tried. But I'd have to change what I eat, not just how much I eat. So anyway, that's sort of this whole idea that you get fat because you eat too much. That's how thin people think about it. And then the tragedy is they convince people with obesity to think about it the same way. So you all think I'm failing myself. Not only is my body failing me, but I'm failing it. Which is just wrong.
Yeah, and a lot of those interventions, when you do them that way, they don't work. I can speak from experience.
Well,
they don't.
That's the thing.
Yeah. So.
Well, or they make you hungry. This is, you know, we talked about Ansel Keys, and this is the point. So Ansel Keys is this University of Minnesota nutritionist who's famous. Basically, he's the one who got us on this low-fat diet. His advocacy, his zealotry, his bad science pushed us into this idea that we should all avoid fat and eat carbs to prevent heart disease. So in the 1940s, he does a study during World War II, 1942-43, does a study with conscientious objectors at the University of Michigan in which he's going to starve them to see what, because they're worried that the idea is that as the Allied troops in World War II liberate Eastern Europe, they're going to come on famine. Populations that are suffering from famines that have had their food supplies cut off, and they want to understand what to do about this, and they want to understand what Keyes' book was called, The Biology of Human Starvation, because you're going to deal with a lot of people who were starved from the concentration camps. So Keyes takes these, I think it was 33 conscientious objectors, and he cuts their diet in half, so it's literally a semi-starvation diet, which isn't actually that few calories. It's like 1,600 calories. And then he keeps them on this until they lose 25% of their body weight. And then they refeed them and they study this. And he ends up writing these two-volume book about this. And these people thought about food constantly. Okay, they were starving, right? They were eating half the amount of food they wanted. They were hungry all the time. In fact, a few of them, one of them tried to accidentally cut off his fingers. And he succeeded in cutting off two of his fingers with an axe so he could get out of the study. They had to, when they let them walk around town, they had to go on a buddy system because otherwise they would cheat. They couldn't trust them not to like gorge. Some of them took to chewing like 40 pieces of gum a day because they were hungry all the time. They would dream about food. They would doodle about food. Everything they did became about food. And the funny thing is they were lean to begin with, right? Most of them. I mean, back then everyone was relatively lean. A few of them were what we would call overweight today. So they go on that diet. When they're refed at the end of the diet, they're still starving. They eat like 10,000 calories a day, and they all end up fatter than they started. So Keyes and his collaborators call it refeeding obesity that they suffer from. So we've all been there, right? We've all gone on these low-calorie diets. We think about food all the time. And then when we fall off the diet, we gain the weight back, and then we gain a little more, and then we feel guilty.
So yeah, you might do something like getting banned from an all-you-can-eat Chinese restaurant by taking the entire tray of orange chicken to your table. Okay, you know, just hypothetical.
You know, my sophomore year in college, I worked in one of the school cafeterias, and the guy wouldn't, and it was $3 an hour plus all I could eat. And he wouldn't hire me back for my junior year because I ate too much to make it worth his while. Okay, but I was still 360 pounds lighter than you were. Okay, that's the difference. You know, it's not what's happening in our brains. It's not how much we're eating. It's what our bodies want to do with what we eat. Do they want to accumulate fat? And so this is the point I'm making is like you take a thin person, you tell him to eat less, he'll lose weight. He'll be hungry all the time. He'll fall off the diet. He'll go back to his original thin weight plus a little more, and nobody will crucify him for it. And he won't have to feel bad about himself because everyone knows that they shouldn't You know, nobody can live being hungry all the time. But you take someone who's overweight or obese and you give them that same calorie restricted diet, they'll lose some weight. They'll also be hungry all the time. They'll also eventually fall off, gain the weight back, and then they'll be crucified for it. Because then people say, well, they don't have any willpower. And look, we know they lost weight to begin with. Therefore, that tells us it's all about calories. And the fact that you were hungry all the time and might have cut off your fingers if you had an opportunity to get out of your low calorie diet, you know, it's.
Yeah, that's, and it's, you know, I can imagine trying to get out of a diet plan by trying to lose an appendage. That's.
Yeah. But this is, you know, we all went through it. But if you're thin, you don't go through that, right? If you're thin, right. You're thin naturally. You don't have to think about what does it take to live on 1,500 calories a day because you're just thin. So it's sort of, there's this famous cognitive behavioral psychologist, economist actually, named Kahneman. I forget his first name because I always refer to him by his last name. Kahneman had a book called Thinking Fast and Slow, which is a little bit like Good Calories, Bad Calories. It's very thought-provoking, and it should have been half as long. In this book, he's talking about the way people think and the cognitive delusions we have, and he's got this concept he calls what you see is all there is. Wysiati, W-Y-S-I-A-T-I. And the idea is, that's how we formulate our ideas about the universe, is what we see. And if you're thin, you never have to experience a starvation diet unless you were unlucky enough to be in a concentration camp. You never have to think about what your hunger and your weight, how they're related. And you never have to really experience what the rest of us experience who aren't thin. So the reason we end up on low-carb ketogenic diets is because we can lose weight pretty effortlessly without being hungry. And we're not trying to live on 1,500 calories a day. We're not eating, you know, ice cream scoops full of chicken salad on a lettuce cup, which was like a typical diet meal in the 70s. You know, we're eating some pretty substantial meals. I don't know how you eat today, but I could imagine that there, you don't feel like you're, I don't know. I'm curious. Give me a typical breakfast, lunch.
You know, it can vary based on the day and oftentimes varies on the amount of physical output that I'm doing. But I found that I do very well on a higher protein diet and with a higher fat diet. So like yesterday, my meal, and it was my meal for the entire day, I made a 1 pound burger patty.
Right.
With some chorizo, some bacon, and a portobello mushroom for the bun. And that was my meal. And that's what I ate all day, and I was happy.
Right.
Some days I may have a little bit more, but I do eat a lot of eggs. I will have a bulletproof style. I call them Fatty Joe's coffees. I do that more for my brain than I do for fat loss. I do that because it when I drink those MCT oils, my brain seems to function better.
Right.
And so that's why I do those. But I've gotten down to the point, and I never thought I would be this way, but I've gotten to the point where I am eating one meal a day. It's a substantial meal, but I eat one meal a day usually, and then I'm on for the rest of the day.
Yeah. Interesting. That one meal is probably, I'm thinking, 3,000 to 4,000 calories. I'm saying pound of, no, actually, I don't know. How much is that?
I threw an egg there was an egg on top of the burger too. So there's burger, cheese, egg, you know. So
on the ground beef is 1,500 calories. Yeah, no, that's lean meat.
So this was ground chuck, so I got a fattier cut. It was from a local farm, but I don't count my calories. I don't pay attention to it. I just eat till I'm satisfied, and I try not to snack.
I know. One of the things I've been railing against is the concept of overeating, right? Because nobody really knows if they're overeating unless they're getting fatter. So they say you get fatter because you're overeating. And then if you ask researchers that I have a chance to do as a journalist, well, then how do you define, how do you define overeating if you, and then it's basically the answer is, well, that's what people are doing when they're getting fatter, right? Yeah. I said, yeah, but you just said the cause of getting fatter is overeating. So isn't that kind of a circular logic? And then they, their eyes glaze over and they decide I'm being annoying, which I'm sure I am. To me, the concept of overeating is when I clearly know I'm stuffed.
Right.
And that I can walk away from the table and I'm not going to do it because I like what I'm eating.
Right.
But I have to define it that way. And it's a very familiar phenomenon. I was always, because I was, you know, Gary, the guy you give everyone to. You know, just give him the leftovers and he'll finish it. And my family used to do that. But again, I still weighed 360 pounds less than you at my peak, eating as much as humanly possible. The fact that you can do that and not be hungry.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that complicates the science. So people say, well, look, you know, Yogi's eating 3,000 calories less than he used to, which could be, and what he used to might have included, I don't know, a lot.
Probably at one of my peak points, we had those giant New York pizzas where each slice of pizza was like 3 feet long. I could kill an entire one myself and still be ready for dessert. So like I had a point in my life where I was like a bottomless pit. I couldn't get enough food.
Right. Well, and that's what, you know, but and that's what complicates it is, like I said, this idea that, is that why you're so heavy? Or are you so heavy? Are you eating like that because your body wants to be that heavy? Your hormonal milieu is so dysregulated. Your fat, it's like your body wants to be an elephant. Some people's bodies want to be greyhounds. I used to joke about this because you always get these people telling you, like lean people, marathon runners will always tell you that if you ran marathons, you'd be lean too. And I'd say that's like a greyhound telling a basset hound. Like if we just get the basset hound to run around the track a few times, it'll look like a greyhound. And that's not what happens. You end up with this emaciated, broken down basset hound. But it's still an animal that wants to be fatter than the greyhound. You know, your body wanted to be 600 pounds in a carb-rich environment.
Right.
And that's the key. That's like, say you manifested a 600 pound phenotype in a carb rich environment, but in a carb poor environment, you're only a 300 pounder. Who knows? Maybe you're even 240 if you play it right, but
I'm working on it.
You know, but that could be more than your body can do at this point. I have a friend, really, really smart kid who was 400 pounds when he was 18. And we've talked about that. He switched to a ketogenic diet, excuse me, and lost 130 pounds in 4 months. So he dropped to 270. And when we talk about our weight, his weight, we think he's sort of, his natural weight is about 270. So if he eats to satiety of, you know, basically what you're eating for dinner, he'll weigh around 270. He can get under that. But he can't eat to satiety. He's got to sort of consciously cut off some of the food and he can get down. I think he's been as low as 190, but I don't believe he could ever sustain that. And, you know, his body sort of naturally wants to be 270 and it's 400 in a high carb environment and it's, you know, 270 in a low carb environment.
Do you think some of the overeating and weight gain could be caused by the lack of micronutrients that are in a lot of today's foods that, you know, in order for us to keep going and actually get satiated, we're trying to get this nutrition in, body's not receiving it, so it keeps sending out those hunger signals?
You know, it's possible. Anything's possible, but it's not my first choice. Yeah, a lot of... So the story of nutrition research is the nutritionists sort of settle on paradigms without really understanding the science at the time. So the driving paradigm in the 20th century, there's something called the new nutrition that came in around 1915 through 1935. And it's this idea that, you know, vitamins and minerals are absolutely necessary to avoid chronic deficiency diseases. And so you eat a balanced diet to satisfy the need for, to make sure you get enough of the macronutrients, the micronutrients, because you don't know what you're missing. So if you're eating some from category A and some from, you know, column B and some from column C and all the way through column F, you could be pretty sure you're going to get everything you need. And that's how that thinking about micronutrients and macronutrients was completely independent from thinking about hormonal regulation of blood sugar, blood pressure, fat accumulation. And when we started to understand that, that was done by endocrinologists who study hormones or PhD researchers who study fat metabolism and biochemists, and not by nutritionists. So nutritionists are always trying to explain obesity through their sort of macronutrient, micronutrient perspective. And the idea is that you're going to just keep eating until you satisfy those micronutrients. But what I'm saying is keeping eating doesn't really matter unless your fat tissue is programmed to accumulate the fat, the calories that you're consuming, because you could always burn them off. You could upregulate your metabolism a little bit. And it's funny, even at 600 pounds, I could probably do this in my head. So you were 600 at 18 when you graduated high school?
Yeah, about then, yeah. And then okay, I lost. So
and how tall were you?
I'm about 6'6".
Okay, so let's say if you were 220, that had been a healthy weight. So you're 380 pounds overweight. And over 18 years, I'm going to have to go to Google here with my glasses on. 380 times 3,500, which is the calories in a pound of fat, divided by 365, which is divided by times 8. Okay, so you stored about 200 calories a day in your fat tissue that your friends weren't.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you had a lean friend who, you know, by 18 was 6'5", 220, starring a, you know, power forward on the high school basketball team, you were storing 200 calories a day that he wasn't. That's about, you know, a third of a McDonald's quarter pounder with cheese that you were eating that he wasn't.
And then he said, I think the one thing that's clear is that the body doesn't exactly run on the laws of thermodynamics like many of the nutritionists think it does.
Well, no, it does. It follows the laws of thermodynamics, but it's not the, it's like your hormones and the enzymes on your cells and the receptors on your cells are telling, like, it's not enough just to increase intake to increase fat accumulation, because you could increase intake and then burn it off, or you could excrete it away, you could poop it away. There are a lot of ways you can deal with what you've just eaten. Like I said, my friend who never got over 195 pounds, but probably ate 6,000 calories a day. He was, you know, he worked out 5 hours a day. Yeah. That's all he wanted to do. But if he didn't do that, he wouldn't have gotten fat, although he probably would have eaten slightly less. So your body has to sort of want to store the calories as fat, and that's a hormonal problem. And so even if you're not getting enough micronutrients, you know, having the, what the nutrition obesity community have been trying to do since World War II is they've been trying to explain why fat people eat so much. Because they assume that you get fat because you eat too much. And then they have to explain why you eat too much and thin people don't, even though they know thin people eat a lot, but don't get fat. There's just all kinds of crazy logic here. So this was one of the theories to try and explain why you might eat too much, why you might continue consuming calories beyond the point that your body will expend them. But what it doesn't take into account is somewhere between expenditure and intake, your body's storing them as fat. And it has to decide whether or not to release them, and that's regulated by hormones. And those hormones are affected by the macronutrients, the carbohydrates, protein, and fat you're eating.
Right. Now, there's other things that are affected by the carbohydrates, fat, and protein that you eat too, and that's your brain function. Right. And we're seeing a lot of evidence of that. And it seems to me that one of the side effects of going to a low-carb, low-fat diet for many people is the lowered brain function, lowered ability to regulate emotions. And we see the reverse when people go on a higher fat diet in many situations where they calm down. Now, I'm not saying this is an absolute thing, but one of the main reasons Carrie and I got involved with the low carb diet was for our mental health. Have you done a lot of research on the diet and mental health aspects?
You know, I keep up with the research, and the clinical trials are interesting, but they're not definitive. Mm-hmm. And I mean, what gives me hope is that there's a lot of researchers looking into it now. There's a surprising number of clinical trials being done where they're putting people on low carb, high fat diets, and there's some indications, particularly with people who suffer from diabetes, that when they get on low carb, high fat diets, you see better cognition, lower rates of depression. But it really, mostly it's anecdotal. I wouldn't discount the anecdotal information, but I'm sure that if you were interviewing a fruitarian who thought we should all be eating bananas, 20 bananas a day, he would say the same thing. So ultimately you need the clinical trials to know. But again, it's one thing you can try yourself and see. You know, we talked about, I played football in college, and then I boxed after college. So I've had 5 or 6 concussions that I know about. And, you know, now in my 60s, I have issues with remembering words. I don't know if they're different from the issues that anyone else has, because I only know what my brain does, not what other people's brains do. And I worry that I had too many concussions, and I worry that I'm not getting enough carbohydrates in my diet. But if I wanted to, I could add more carbs back and see if my verbal skills improve.
I found for me, because I was hitting a point when I was in the truck, and I can't really, I could also explain kind of where the Carrie's logic came from, going to the high carb or the high fat diet away from the high carb diet. But for me, my brain felt like it was underwater all the time. I was having a difficult time with short-term memory loss. I was having kind of uncontrolled emotions, being real depressed at certain times. And when I switched the diet over, I used to scuba dive. I know what my head feels like when I'm down 3 or 4 atmospheres. And that's the way my head felt, like, just naturally. And when I went on to the low carb diet, especially when I started increasing MCT into my diet, through either the MCT oil or through butter and coconut oil, my brain just it fired up like crazy. And a lot of these issues that I was having mentally just kind of dissipated.
And you hear that anecdotally. Like I said, you just don't know. Maybe you got lucky. Maybe it's a placebo effect. When I was younger, it's funny, I used to do these sushi diets in my 20s. I lived in New York, and I was always, so I would eat sushi for 3 weeks and lose 10 pounds. And at the end of 3 weeks, I would get suicidal. Well, not quite suicidal, but I would wake up just wanting to cry. And this was a reproducible phenomenon. And I remember I would go to the nearest McDonald's and have a double quarter pounder with cheese. And it was like an antidepressant working in real time. I could feel it coursing through my frontal lobe and making that sense of wanting to cry all the time just vanish. And but again, you know, who knows what was going on. There are people now studying this phenomena that you're describing. There's so many ways you can be fooled. And like I said, I'm sure if we were talking about people pushing, you know, talking to people pushing, advocating for other diet treatments, they would be saying the same thing. But
For Carrie, she was dealing with type 2 bipolar issues. Right. And the medications she was given were the same medications that people put for epilepsy. And so she happened to hook up with Ted Naiman. He goes, you know, they've been using the keto diet to treat people in epilepsy. Why don't you try that? And her symptoms reversed. That, she was massively be deficient because she's MTHFR gene mutation, and she doesn't methylate the B vitamins.
Well, this is one of the things that I always advise people. If they have cognitive issues, it's like, why don't you try the diet? It's you're literally changing the fuel on which your brain is running. Yeah. So if you're having issues burning glucose, carbohydrates for energy in the brain, and you've got memory or depression or anything, see what happens if you burn ketones. That's what happens. You're switching over to burning ketones for fuel. When you're taking the MCT oil, it's easy. Well, the MCT, medium-chain triglycerides, might make it into the brain on some level, but they also fuel ketogenesis, so they upregulate your ketones. See what happens. Maybe you find when you run your brain on ketones or your nervous system on ketones instead of carbs, you don't have these problems. And I'm always surprised when you get pushback from that, because I think people are afraid to change anything. They're afraid to be disappointed.
Well, we're very absolutist as people, especially in this country. I've had an opportunity to travel around, and we tend to get the ideas in our head that there's only one right way to do things. And I mean, that's why the kale diet became such a huge thing, because somebody mentioned that kale is healthy. So that must be all I should eat now, is kale. We have these absolutist notions about all kinds of subjects, but it really plays into, dietary. People get as crazy about dietary notions as they get about politics.
Yeah, I, just along those lines, 1959, the New York Times ran a story on the new craze in diets. So this is, 61 years ago, and I've always saved. I just pulled this up from my desktop because I found it so annoying. So there's a paragraph in this 61-year-old article. It says, on this count, it is illuminating to note the words of Dr. Alvin R. Feinstein, a New York internist who has made an intensive study of obesity. Nutritionists, he said, habitually ignore the subjective aspect of food. Many dietitians are uninterested in how food tastes. Standard books on nutrition don't cover the caloric content of pizza, pie, a pastrami sandwich, or gin and tonic. It's as if these specialists were determined to impose the neo-Calvinistic dogma, thou must eat kale.
That's great.
Feinstein really nailed that one. I kind of like it. The kale growers of America must be just absolutely, delighted by how the world has turned to their,
I like my veggies. I grew up in the country, and I grew up picking, I was originally from Ohio, then transplanted to California. But when I was in Ohio, we grew a lot of our stuff. So greens and veggies, I'm good with. I love them. But yeah. I also look at how I function. And I do function better, higher protein. So there's a lot of times where I kind of cycle in and out of different dietary styles, from carnivore to a little bit more carbohydrates, a little bit more greens, then back toward more of a carnivore type approach. And it's just based on how my body's reacting to things, trying to read signals and how my brain's reacting.
Ultimately, this comes down on some level to self-experimentation, because we are different. So I'm skeptical that anyone can be healthy long-term eating large amounts of sugar and refined grains. I'm agnostic about seed oils because I just don't know that science well. So you get rid of the sugar and the white flour, and then it's like, how low do you have to go in carbs to make your body function? Yeah. It's such that your body can function properly, and you could be a healthy weight and eat to satiety, and then even the green vegetables, I eat them and I like them, but I eat them mostly because my mother told me they were good for me, in the 1960s. I have the research I don't think actually exists. Nobody's done a clinical trial to see if you're healthier eating broccoli than not.
It seems to be very little clinical, real actual clinical trials. And a lot of the research that I have seen where they're doing, they're coming out, let's say, like the China study. It doesn't seem like they count for all the variables. They're not really doing that, because the people are out eating and then they come back and they survey them. What did you eat last year? you know? Go ahead.
It's just that whole science. It's called epidemiology, or risk factor epidemia. And that was when my physicist friends in the late 80s told me I should get into public health because the science is terrible. Yeah. That's what they were talking about, specifically those types of studies. And the people who run those studies are now the most influential nutritionists in the country. Whenever you hear the phrase, you know, we have to eat fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, you know, lean meat in moderation, lean fish, that's all this epidemiology where you look at what people eat who stay healthy and who tend to be higher socioeconomic status and more educated and a gazillion other things. And you look at the people who don't stay healthy and you say, well, we should all eat what the healthier people are eating. But it's just, it doesn't, it's like saying, if you looked at what cars they drove, the people who were unhealthy would become truck drivers and the people who are healthy would drive Volvos. And then you would say, well, if we all drove Volvos, we would all be healthy. And it just doesn't really equate to that. So it's just, a lot of our belief system is based on terrible science, and ultimately it's about deciding who to believe and then experimenting to see what happens and hopefully not killing yourself in the experiment.
Yeah. I mean, for the most part, there are obviously exceptions to the rules, but it seems like if you stick with whole real foods in your experimentation and try to avoid a lot of the, and I hate to use the word processed food because everything you eat is processed. And that's, I think people kind of jump on terms and go nuts about a term and then freak out about it, but they don't realize how processed everything is in their life. Right. But when you're coming toward, getting into more synthetics and things that maybe may not, your body may not be used to enough to process.
Right.
But even with a whole real food, I've talked to people about this who get off on the whole, it's natural. It's not going to hurt you. It's not going to, it came from the ground. It was, so did half the plants on the planet that will kill you. Like, you know, all the, they all came from the ground, you know, but, another one that I always tell people is like oysters, one of the most nutrient dense foods on the planet. But if you're allergic to shellfish, it's toxic. So you always got to be careful about what you put in your body and how your body reacts to it.
Yeah. And that's it. So there's some general rules and then it's self-experimentation. Try it, see what happens. Even with food issues, I recently gave up nuts. I was living on, you know, I eat two meals a day, and then between lunch and dinner, I was probably eating 1,000 calories of almonds, and then I switched to macadamia nuts, and I had a health issue, and I was curious. I thought it was diet-related, so I was doing experiments, giving up various food groups for the course of, you know, 3 weeks, and when I gave up the nuts, it went away, which was kind of a bummer because I like nuts. But I felt better and I looked better. So it was like, okay, now I'm nut free for whatever reason. It sort of, it was, turns out it was a kind of nut allergy. I don't know why. Yeah. But
we've seen those allergies can come and go too, as you sometimes, maybe there's something else going on that maybe stimulates a sensitivity to something.
Well, it's funny because I used to say I couldn't tolerate cheese. I had to give up dairy. But now that I've given up nuts, I seem to be able to tolerate cheese better, which I also missed.
Well, there you go.
You sound crazy when you start talking like this, right? So the mainstream people are thinking, oh, Jesus. But it sort of, seems to make perfect common sense. If you have symptoms that could be food related, try modulating your dietary intake. If it's an allergy, there's a whole protocol, an elimination protocol to eliminate different aspects of food, different foods in your diet until you identify what's causing the allergy.
Now, it seems like nowadays a lot of the research that's coming out has been really fired up by a lot of the citizen scientists such as yourself, Dave Feldman, Ira Cummings, Nina Teicholz. And now we actually have more people approaching on the clinical side, the clinical researchers. We have things like Berta Health popping in. Where do you see the research going for more of a dietary approach to fix a lot of the problems that are going?
I don't know what's going to happen to the research. I think companies like Virta, so Virta Health is a San Francisco-based startup that's going after type 2 diabetes with a lot of internet-enabled tools and smartphone tools, and then ultimately nutritional ketosis, as they call it, as their primary intervention. I think companies like that are going to change the world if it changes, if we succeed, because, and something I talk about in my next book a lot is this, when I started writing about this stuff 20 years ago, there may be a dozen physicians in the world who are advocating, you know, low carb, high fat, ketogenic diets for their patients. And if they could get their patients to find, most of them, half of those had written diet books. So like Mike and Mary Dan Eats and, you know, the guys who wrote Sugar Busters. Today there's conservative estimate, I'm guessing a few tens of thousands around the world, doctors who think that the single best prescription they can give their patients are these low carb, high fat diets. So if they can get their patients to eat like we do, they can make their patients healthy. And each one of these is like a little node of infection in the medical community. Because as their patients start getting healthy, their obese patients lose weight, their type 2 diabetic patients, you know, resolve their diabetes. And then those patients have like kidney specialists are seeing and cardiologists are seeing and allergists are seeing. And the allergists say, geez, what did you do? And they say, how'd you get so healthy? And they say, well, I, you know, did this low carb. Some of them try to talk them out of the diet still. They'll say, oh, you're killing yourself. There's all that saturated fat. But others will say, well, that's interesting. Maybe I should try it. So you see this, the efficacy of the diet convinces the physicians and they convince their patients. It used to be, again, 20 years ago, if you wanted to do this, you read a diet book and then you're, even if you lost 50 pounds, your doctor was horrified. Now, if your doctor tells you to do it and gives you the diet book, it's an entirely different scenario. And now, and that's happening as we speak. You know, it's competing with the vegan diet and vegetarian, most plant movements. I don't know. The mostly plant people insist on saying we're all wrong, which isn't quite what we're saying about them, but it is what it is. So I think all of that, though, is sort of spreading. It's changing people, you know, your friends, your trucker acquaintances are going to say, Jesus, Yogi, how'd you lose 300 pounds? And it's like, I ate like this and I followed this diet. You know, there are websites you could follow and, you know, gazillion cookbooks now. So even without the research, there's a huge movement towards doing this. I don't know how far it'll get, whether it'll go far enough to sort of tip the establishment with it, but it's there. And then there are people doing studies, like I said, and tend to be on problems that are easier, rather than looking at chronic disease states, looking at things like depression and cognition. And, you know, I just recently was on the clinicaltrials.gov website, which is where researchers list the trials they're doing. And there were half a dozen studies being done on type 1 diabetes, which clearly, you know, fascinating work is going on. So the world is changing when we're almost becoming mainstream. I mean, keto is the most searched diet term on Google and has been for like 6 years now. We're getting to that point where the medical community is saying, well, we knew it all along. You know, we knew this diet was good for weight loss, blah, 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 you know.
But
it'll kill you in the long run. That's still the problem. It's all that saturated fat. And now there's a large, you know, the environmental issue is an interesting one. I don't quite know how to deal with that, because if I think animal agriculture can be improved enormously such that its contribution to climate change is less, or to greenhouse gases is less, and I, you know, but that doesn't help. That's pushback also when people are saying, you know, my kids living in Northern California get all kinds of pressure to give up meat by their vegetarian 11-year-old friends who think they're harming the environment.
Yeah.
And they might be. I tend to doubt it, but.
Yeah, you know, I think a skeptic, an open-minded skeptic is an important thing to be in this day and age.
No, that's what I was taught to be, yeah.
Yeah, because frankly, it doesn't seem like there's enough of them around anymore. You know, especially with the social media outlets and things like that. But, you know, even for me, if I've come to find out tomorrow that eating a lot of meat isn't doing the things that it was doing before, and that I should include sweet potatoes, and that'll benefit me. I'm going to do what benefits me.
Yeah, but you're going to test it, because I've tried.
Right.
The paleo people are always arguing for sweet potatoes. So about every couple years or every year, I often make potatoes or sweet potatoes for my family when I cook. Mm-hmm. So every, once a year, I'll decide, okay, I'm going to have some sweet potatoes, and I'll start off small because I know I am. And an hour after dinner, I'm in a coma on the couch. I'm watching TV with my wife, and I'm like sound asleep, and I'm desperately trying not to be asleep, but I can't fight it. And I think, okay, maybe that's just, if I ate the sweet potatoes every day for like a week, my body will adjust. You know, when you don't eat carbs, you have your pancreas gets lazy and doesn't respond properly when you do. But then I started thinking, do I really want to eat something that takes me a week to ramp up to, just so I can now add sweet potatoes? So, and that's where the self-experiment comes in. I experiment, the experiment fails, and I go back to not eating sweet potatoes.
Right.
But yeah, it's some interesting issues. Anyway, I should be
I have
another call coming in about 3 minutes.
I'll go ahead and let you go. Normally, I close out with some questions, but I look forward to maybe having you back on the podcast when your new book comes out.
That would be nice. I'd like that.
I'd love to hear it. I'd love to read the book and then bring you on so we can talk about it.
Okay. Well, let's make that happen.
All right. Sounds great. Right. Thank you so much for being on the show. And we will be getting these out. We're just starting out right now, so we got to accumulate the Apple portfolio to submit. So you're one of our early, we brought you on as part of a series called The Early Influencers. So where could, if somebody wants to get in contact with you, they want to get into your research with your nonprofit, how do they contact you?
Well, the best way is to go through my website, which is just garytaubes.com. The nonprofit is nusi.org, so they can see what we've done. And, anyone who wants to donate hundreds, thousands, or millions of dollars towards research, we can make some very interesting research projects happen. And at the moment, it's,
Thank you for joining us on the Fatty Joe Show. Be sure to leave a comment and subscribe. It helps the show reach more people. To support the show, as well as Kerry Brown and Yogi's work on the blog, keto recipe development, masterclasses, and to gain access to private Facebook groups and other awards, go to patreon.com/thefattyjoeshow or patreon.com/Kerry Brown. Also, check out our Kerry Brown and Yogi Parker YouTube channel for video versions of The Fatty Joe Show, recipe videos, and more. Join our awesome community on the Facebook group, The Keto Kitchen with Kerry Brown and Yogi Parker. And check out our kerrybrown.com website for recipes, blog posts, discounts, cookbooks, masterclasses, and other great stuff. Thank you so much.